Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome back to the Salyer Report for the Precious Metals Market Report, a man who needs no introduction, Franklin Sanders. If you look at what's been going on in both the currency markets and the precious metals markets, I've been dying to talk to him. And, of course, this is the way I get to talk to him in depth about precious metals. So, Franklin, it's a cold, sunny day in Tennessee, and it's good to be indoors. And welcome back to the Salyer Report.
Well, thanks. I'm glad to be here. The only other place I might like to be is in Alabama.
Why Alabama?
Well, we had to pick up a bull, and I was going to go, and then I remembered I had to be with you today, and so Justin got to go instead of me. And there's a fairly new breed of cattle called South Poles, which are bred to do very well on nothing but grass. You don't have to feed them grain. And they're just a big, blocky, beautiful beef animal. And so a few weeks ago, what we decided to do is to start breeding those to our Highland cows, because Highland cows take a long time to grow out and they don't put on much fat. So we went to look for a young bull, and we found one on the tail end of Lookout Mountain, which goes down into Georgia and Alabama. And it's just beautiful country. You know, it feels like...
Lookout Mountain is beautiful, beautiful country.
You know how you feel here on our farm? We call it the top of the world farm because it feels like, you know, you're on the top of the world, and somewhere out there there's an edge you could look over and see the rest of the world. And Lookout Mountain feels that same way. And it's just, there's always a lot of energy in a place where people are doing new things. And,
right.
You know, their mental energy seems to flow out and all over the place.
Funny. When I became head of the FHA, we had been the number one property disposition operation in the country. And then when the RTC got created, you know, we became number two. And the guy who was running number one was a great guy. His first name was Lamar. And I'll never forget, he used to always say, "I'm from L.A., that's Lower Alabama."
Yes.
Which, of course, Lower Alabama is one of the prettiest places in the world. So,
yes.
Anyway, well, we're going to talk about precious metals. We want to get an update, and we're also going to talk about precious metals at the very heart of the rebalancing of the global economy, because there is a war going on, and gold is right at the heart of it. So, it's been quite a ride this year. You know, gold ran up and then it's down. Then it went back up, but it's touched that 1200 line more times than I care to remember. And each time it's I don't know if it's a heartbreaker or, you know, you feel like you're on a roller coaster. So anyway, the one thing I wanted to mention was I was watching John Maudlin on a TV show the other day, and he said, somebody asked him if he was selling his gold. He said, "Nope, that's my central bank insurance." He said, I keep an insurance at all times. Anyway, so bring us up to date on the market, Franklin. What's been happening, and what can you tell us about where the market is now?
Okay, just let me add one thing. I saw a quote from Kyle Bass the other day, and he said, "Gold is a no-brainer because it's the same thing as a put on the political system." And I thought, a put option on the whole political system. I thought, well, that's about right. He's got that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Well, let me bring you up to date. And I'll refer to the charts as we go along. If you look at the gold chart, that's about a year. And there's a rule in technical analysis that whenever a market continues to challenge a line, whether it's trying to break through that line on the downside or on the upside, the more times it challenges the line, the greater the possibility that it will break that line. So you had support for gold about 1180, that was hit in June of 2013, and then again in December of 2013, and it looked like it was solid, but then that broke in October of this year, and so that changes the game. Then you say, okay, well, what's the turnaround here? And if you look at that chart, you'll see that gold went down to 1130, And then on December the 1st, we had a most extraordinary day. In fact, just about the most extraordinary day I've ever seen in the gold market. And that is, you can see that big, long black line that shows that it went down to $1,141.70 during the day, but came up back up and closed about 1218. So that's a stupendously strong move, and you notice it happened on very high volume if you look underneath at the volume. So the strength of the move, the strength of the confirmed by the strength of the volume, says that that's at least an interim turnaround, a very strong turnaround. And gold came back, has come back and crossed over the down, not only the short-term downtrend line, which is the little dashed line, but also the downtrend line from October of 2012, which is extremely strong. Now, everything is conditional until it's proved. And this will be the fact that gold has turned around, or the idea that gold has turned around, will only be proved when it gets above that last high, which was $1,255.60. Past that, then, there's resistance around 1300. And then with the real question, or the real hurdle, it comes at what I call the Fisher Cut bait line at $1,350. So where we are now is we have what appears to be the first step of a turnaround. However, you have to remember that there has been so much morale damage done to the gold and silver markets in the last 3.5 years that it will take a while to rebuild that morale. And, you know, it just takes time. That's all. After you do that much damage, it just takes time to rebuild.
I'll tell you what my concern is, because, you know, there are two – I want to go through both sides of the market on this one. If you look at what's been going on in the currency world, mm-hmm. We have had cheap dollars available to borrow all over the globe now for years with quantitative easing.
Yes.
And with that ending and the possibility that the feds could raise the interest rates, there is what I call a bear trap coming in the dollar. Mm-hmm. And the dollar's gone up about 10%, a little bit more, since mm-hmm. the middle of the year. Mm-hmm. But you could see the dollar go much, much higher if that happens, because you've got countries all over the world that need to borrow, you know, that have borrowed dollars. They're going to need to either pay back in dollars or pay interest in dollars, and they have to earn those dollars, whereas, you know, the U.S. doesn't. You know, it can just print them. And so I'm really concerned about the dollar flying up much higher and what that could do to everything.
You're anticipating what I'm going to say. You're stealing my thunder, Catherine.
Okay. Okay. I'll shut up.
We're going to get to the dollar very shortly.
Okay.
And I'll explain why I left that to last. The second chart shows the silver market. And here you have the same sort of setup that you had in gold. You had triple, in fact, quadruple bounces off of the 1860 level. And again, every time you hit that line again, the likelihood that you will go through the line increases. And so you see that in September, silver broke through that 1860 line and went on down sharply. And then you had that colossal reversal on high volume. And in silver's case, it actually went down to $14.15 and closed at $16.69, which is an enormous range, over $2. In all these years of watching gold and silver, I don't believe I've ever seen anything like that on the upside. The only thing that compares to it was the huge fall in April of 2013. So if you look at where silver is on the chart, you can see that it's broken up through both the 20-day and the 50-day moving averages, which means that its momentum is above the market. The momentum is carrying it higher. And it's also broken through the high that was made in August of 2013. Well, I'm sorry, it has not broken through that yet. It's almost at that point. But all of this is just talk until it breaks through that 1860 line, because what was support for so long now becomes resistance when you're coming at it from the underside.
Right.
You'll notice, too, that the 200-day moving average is right now at 1903, and that really is the line that we have to get through, because the market's momentum is down. The 200-day moving average is a very, very long-term moving average, and so when the market is below that 200-day moving average, it means that momentum is still carrying it downwards, and it's like trying to climb with a big bag of rocks on your back. So once we get above that 200-day moving average, everything gets a lot prettier for silver and gold. And the halfway point of the whole rise from 2001 to 2011 is about $24, a little over $24. So that halfway point is very important too, because the halfway point is like the pivot on a seesaw. It's like the fulcrum on a seesaw, and there's a lot of momentum for the market when it's above the halfway point. So that's what we're seeing in silver and gold. And if you look at the next chart, number three should be the Dow Jones Industrials in silver and gold. And what you see there, here's the importance of this chart. It tells me which is going to rise against which. Are the metals going to rise against stocks, or are stocks going to outperform silver and gold? And so I watched this chart very closely, because
it's a ratio chart?
Yes. The Dow gold and the Dow silver. Because that's the most important indicator I see. And there's no point in arguing with it. If you're arguing with it, you're just hitting yourself in the head with a ball peen hammer. If you look at the industrials gold chart, you can see that it looked like it had topped. Remember, we had the bottoms in gold about 1180. So there at the end of December, it looked like it had topped where those blue arrows are. And then again in June, it made another top. But then it broke out in September above the line that marked those double tops. So that proved, nope, those weren't tops. And then it came back and rose to a new high, but it made a double top. And then it formed this megaphone or broadening top formation that you see there at the top. It's since broken down out of that. It's broken down through the 50-day moving average, but we won't have a sure confirmation until it closes below the 200-day moving average, which right now is about 13.29 ounces. You look at the silver chart, it looks a lot the same. You see the same broadening top formation, the same double top. You see the same breakdown out of the megaphone or jaws of death formation. And again, we need confirmation at the 200-day moving average, which also happens to be one of the uptrend lines. So it looks like it's turned, but I can't say that it has yet, because we don't have that wonderful confirmation of closing below the 200-day moving average. And then I'm going to steal my thunder back. Let's talk about chart number five, which is the U.S. dollar index. What was plainly seen coming in the U.S. dollar index was a upside-down head and shoulders formation, which is a reversal formation, a reversal from down to up. And that took quite a while to form this year, and then it broke out in July, right there about 81 and 50. And then it rose higher, and it formed what's called a rising wedge. That's outlined by the green lines on this chart. And you'll notice that a few days ago it failed at the top of that formation, and it's fallen back. But we really need to get confirmation. It really needs to close below about 87.50. And that'll tell us, yes, it's fallen out of that rising wedge, which normally resolves by falling down. However, what this chart right here, if you could see a longer-term version of this chart, and by longer-term I mean, say, a five-year chart, you would see that you have drawn the correct conclusion. It implies that the dollar will go much higher. When I say much higher, I mean, 93.5, something like that, which is substantially higher.
Right.
And if that happens,
see, I think it could go through 100. That's my concern.
Oh well, it might. Yeah, I mean, if you get a big demand for the dollar, here's the problem. There are a lot of people in the world who have been short dollars, who've been playing the dollar carry trade because the Federal Reserve has been guaranteeing that the interest rates would not go up, so they could borrow dollars, and for a long time the dollar was falling, so they could pay back in cheaper dollars that they were borrowing at virtually no cost. Now when they have to reverse that trade, when they, let's say they took the dollars and invested them in stocks, now the stocks are coming down and the dollar's going up, and they're caught in a vice. So they've got to get out. They've got to reverse that carry trade. They've got to go buy dollars and sell stocks. And even if this thing is more even if this carry trade is more complicated, where they're borrowing yen and you know they're selling yen and buying dollars and so forth, what it's doing is putting upward pressure on the dollar. I do not believe that a rising dollar necessarily cuts off gold and silver. I mean, they can rise in the face of a rising dollar. They can't rise, I don't think, over any long period of time in the face of a rising stock market. So,
do you think they can rise in the face of rising interest rates?
Oh, yeah, sure. Here's the main thing. What is it that causes gold and silver to rise? It's not that they're inflation hedges. Because you can look, for instance, at the period from 2001 until 2008, and gold and silver are just humming right along, and the inflation during that time was not that terrible. There was inflation all during the period 1980 to 2000, and silver and gold were falling the entire time. So it's not so much that gold and silver hedge against inflation as it is they're a hedge against falling confidence in the financial markets. And the financial markets are stocks, bonds, and currencies. And the currency, of course, forms the value or is what gives value to the bond market and to an extent to the stock market. So what happens is when you get a falling confidence in the gold and silver in the financial market, people run into gold and silver. That's monetary. That's what I call monetary demand. And it's monetary demand that drives gold and silver. It's not physical demand. It's not even so much inflation. I mean, ultimately, yes, inflation's down underneath there. That's the reason people lose confidence in the financial system. But the inflation can go in a long time without helping silver and gold, and it's a matter of confidence.
Except for this, though, and that is you've got 1.3 billion people in China and, you know, and a huge population in India as well, and they're gold and silver buyers. You know, they hold wealth in gold and silver. And, you know, if you come here, more and more people hold, you know, a much greater portion of the population holds wealth in financial assets. And so I think as the middle class grows in Asia, the question is, how much are they going to stick with their traditional gold and silver, you know, bank deposits and real estate, and are they going to switch to financial assets? And that's one of the big variables in what could happen here. Because even if the U.S. stock market does well, I think one of the big questions is, does the Indian Chinese stock market do well? And will those populations be buying gold and silver? Because if they're buying gold and silver, the demand's going to be huge.
Right, and remember, these are marginal things that you're talking about. In other words, the question is, how do they balance? How do those demands balance against each other? Is the demand for financial assets greater than the demand for physical assets or not? The Chinese have a history of distrust of paper money that goes back 2,000 years. I mean, we're talking about an ancestral memory that can't be matched in the West for what paper money or inflation can do to you. So they know, they understand, the Indians do too, but they don't have the same historical experience with it. One of the things that China that puts me maybe in a very small minority is I don't believe it. I've gotten reports from eyewitnesses for the last 15 years, 10 or 15 years, that the investment there has been misdirected. I've got stories about building ghost cities in the, you know, out in the country where they, you know, they build whole new cities and put together turnkey plants but there's no demand, and that, you know, the people never move in. So I'm being asked to believe, when I'm told the story of the Chinese miracle, economic miracle, I'm being asked to believe that a socialist economy can perform well. I don't doubt that it can perform well in some ways, and certainly the fulfillment of huge amounts of American demand has moved jobs and industry to China. But what about the misdirection? And one of these days, that misdirection is going to come home, and when it does, there's going to be a big train wreck there. So, you know, that's one of the questions in my mind. That's one of the, what I think of the imponderables. I think, yes, the Chinese are, you know, their economy has improved enormously, but how much disaster is still being covered up and waiting to emerge?
So, I don't, you know, I know, you know, because I have lots of personal reports in the real estate as well. So I'm not saying those things don't go on, mm-hmm. but I just think the Chinese are going to power through. And if you look at all the things they have going for them, it's, you know, they have the wherewithal to keep growing and to handle their problems. So I really don't think you're going to get a train wreck. But I do think the Chinese have serious, here's the biggest problem. Our landmass, Franklin, is bigger than the Chinese, and they've got four times as many people. They've got less arable land and less water. Imagine having 400% more people in the United States on our landmass with a significantly less arable land and water. What's that like? Can you imagine trying to keep everybody employed? So I do think, you know, they have enormous entrepreneurial and intellectual skills. And, you know, frankly, they were the lead economy until 200 years ago. So you know, the IMF or World Bank just announced their GNP surpassed ours, but, you know, so it's been that way through most of history, and part of it is they just got so many people. But I'm not worried about their train wreck. I do think that part of what I see going on around the world is when I started buying precious metals, it was a very tiny, thin market. And what I do see is a much more, the consolidation in the prices has led to many, many more people buying gold and silver and educating themselves as gold and silver. It was almost as though the prices had gone too high and shut out a lot of the market. And there's a real building out of the retail market. And with the Chinese and Indians wanting to buy, I just see no matter what happens, there's going to be, to me, more and more building out of the retail market, and so I wanted to ask you about what have you been seeing in terms of interest on the physical side in the retail market? Are people buying? Are they using this as an opportunity to accumulate?
Big buyers are coming back into the market, but not, it's still in the beginning stages, but those big buyers are coming back into the market. And so we're seeing, you know, way more activity. We've seen way more activity since September than we had seen for quite some time. So, and that's just anecdotal evidence. That's just one little business's experience. But some fairly large traders are coming back in. Silver, here's an interesting thing about silver. Did you know that the silver ETF has actually increased its inventory while the gold inventory, the GLD inventory, the ETFs is what I'm talking about, sorry. The silver ETF inventory has increased and the gold inventory has decreased, which I find very interesting. Because
that is interesting.
It indicates that more and more people are buying silver even as the price goes down.
Well, I keep getting, you know, reports on very strong demand for silver coins at the mint. Is that the case?
That's true. And let me just mention one other thing that probably is an even better indicator than that. And that is the premium on 90% silver coin. Premium, of course, is that amount that you have to pay above the gold or silver value to get some physical item in gold or silver. And that premium for 10 years, with one with the exception of the time of the financial panic, has been the lowest of any item across the market. Well, in 2013, that premium began to rise and got up as high as $5 an ounce over silver, which is huge. I mean,
you're kidding.
No,
that's unbelievable.
And the thing is, it started in January of 2013 when the silver price is going down, and it increased, and it did not moderate even when we had that horrible fall in 2013. It worked back down to the point where the silver became, where 90% silver was like 20 cents, 40 cents an ounce over spot at wholesale back in the summer. And then it started to rise again. And right now it's about $2 an ounce, which is historically high. And there's a relationship between that premium and the price. Normally, when you see that price, it means when you see that premium high, it means that there's huge demand on that stuff, physical demand for that stuff in the market. And that kind of silver, remember, is the most liquid and the most divisible form of silver. So when I see those high premiums, it says to me the silver price, there's huge demand, there's huge physical demand. And that leads to the inference that there's going to be a turnaround, you know, fairly soon. Well, whether we've seen the final turnaround or not, I don't know. You can't say that yet because you don't have the upside confirmation, which would require at least a close in gold above 1350. But I think that's a good working theory for right now. And as I said, even if we've seen the ultimate low in this correction that started in 2011, it's going to take some time to rebuild the market. But the strength is there. I mean, that's what the implication of the high premium on 90% is, and that's what the implication of high demand on silver eagles from the
right. The one thing, it's not that I think it's going to happen, but the one thing I am worried about is if we do get a high dollar scenario next year, and there's a bit of a sort of fear about the liquidity in the bond market that you could. You know, we could end up, if we break the 1100 line, there's, you know, it's a straight shot down to 700 or 800. So I just really want people to be prepared for this thing to swing. You know, I just think you have to be prepared to live through some pretty wild swings up or down and keep your wits about you. And that's the one thing I would warn.
Go ahead.
Yeah, before I go, I want to talk about that in the context of rebalancing the global economy. But before we do, since we're talking about accumulating physical coins, I just wanted to bring up the calculator again.
Yeah.
Because one of the things I discover is, you know, to me, the calculator is an amazing tool. And I can brag about this because it was Franklin's idea. But the silver and gold calculator, which you can link to from Franklin's website or from the Soleri website, the URL is silverandgoldaremoney.com. And it's a wonderful little tool where you can put in an amount of currency in about 20 different currencies, including the dollar. And it will tell you in gold and silver what you need to pay. So it just is a calculator to toggle back and forth between global currencies and gold and silver. It just makes it easy. And there's an equivalence page where if you click on the equivalence page, you can see the melt value of any gold or silver coin. And for a list of the sort of most common bullion coins, both gold and silver. And it's just a wonderful... You know, if you're pricing or valuing your gold and silver coins or negotiating to buy, it's a wonderful tool. And the reason I bring it up is at Christmas time, Christmas was the reason that this happened from my point of view, because I was complaining about trying to reconcile how to calculate, you know, what coins and how much I should give to all the kids, because I have a tendency to gift to the kids in my family using gold and silver. Mm-hmm. And so you started telling me about your idea for the calculator, and the next thing you know, there it is. We decided to do a calculator because, you know, I find that one of the big obstacles for people owning and using gold and silver is not having a ready calculator. And so finally, the audience persuaded us to turn this into an app, so you can get an Android or iPhone app for your phone. And, you know, Franklin does a great job of always saying, if you want to start a community currency, just do it. Just use gold and silver. Get them out of your closet and use them. So if you haven't discovered the calculator, particularly if you are going to be gifting coins to kids for Christmas, it's a great little tool. And as I said, again, there's an equivalence page. And so if you're interested in looking at what the potential coins you might be interested in buying and holding, there it is. So, Franklin, it was your idea, and I just needed it. So I decided to do a whole bunch of work to get it.
Yeah, but it's just so much better when people understand what they've got and what the value is, you know. And I understand it's confusing. So, but with that app, and there's just no excuse. It makes it really easy to know what you've got and what it's worth.
Yeah, it does make it really easy. And somebody's always saying, when I talk to a dealer, how do I calculate the premium? And I said, well, just, you know, go to the equivalence page, and there's the melt value is calculated for you, so it's really easy to figure out what the premium is. Okay, well, let's get back to the rebalancing the global economy, because I was working on our wrap-up. You know, we do the wrap-up at the first Salier report of the year, and it's a very big deal for me. And one of the things I realized is one of the most important stories of the year was all of the politicking and noise around the rebalancing of the global economy. And one of my greatest frustrations this year, Franklin, is meeting at the luncheons and workshops with subscribers and having them ask me about totally absurd scenarios and realizing that the reason that they are worried about them is they don't have a picture of that rebalancing, how it's happening and what it means. And you know, here's the reality. The price of the U.S. dollar, so the U.S. dollar index and the price of gold, is right at the heart of this pendulum swinging back and forth and back and forth and back and forth as this rebalancing goes on. And so one of the things I wanted to do during the wrap-up is really help them get a framework, get a picture of the rebalancing, sort of see it in their mind and not fall prey to some of the more unlikely scenarios that people talk about. So I wanted to touch on, I called you and I said, would you help me with this? Because you're always good at bringing people back to ground. And maybe if we could go through some of the more extreme scenarios and sort of help people look at these in context. So I thought I could bring them up and we could talk a little bit about them. One of the ones that's been driving me crazy for many, many years is the Iraqi dinar.
Oh, my gosh.
So tell us about the Iraqi dinar.
I have actually had people call me up and ask me how to distribute $1 million between silver and gold and what they ought to buy. And we'd carry on this long conversation, me thinking they were serious. And then they would tell me, well, that it, you know, it's going to happen next week. They're going to upvalue the Iraqi dinar. And at that point,
and I'm going to have $1 million.
Yeah. Why anybody has fallen for that story, I can't figure it out. I mean, the story goes something like this. The Iraqi dinar was devalued, literally blowing in the streets, thrown away. But somehow or the other, the Iraqi government is going to come back, and thanks to increased oil production or oil production, is going to revalue the dinar from a tenth of a cent each to $10 each or something like that. And all of these people who have bought these physical dinars, which were, as I said, picked up blowing in the streets, are suddenly going to become fabulously wealthy. And it's
right.
Just, there's not a, I don't even know where to begin with a story like that to say that's just not possible. That's not going to happen.
Well, I've seen extremely intelligent people, you know, end up putting $20,000 to $50,000 in Iraqi dinars, who think they're going to end up with $200 million and you know, or more. And the thing is, it's not just the money they put in, but they put in hundreds, if not thousands, of hours. You know, they'll have legal, you know, lawyers draw up documents for the trust for their kids from, you know, when they get the $200 million. And they're it's not just that they lose their money, they lose their lives to the fantasy.
Yeah.
And it's very, very scary. And the thing that scares me the most about it is all the different things you could be doing with that time that would really be building, you know, real wealth, obviously in far less dramatic but real ways, you know, are ignored while you're living this fantasy. And it's very, very scary to me. Anyways,
it brings back a proverb or axiom that I made for myself years ago, and I'm dead serious about this. I learned my lesson so hard that I wrote on a piece of paper and posted where my eyes would see it every day the motto, "Get rich slow." And you understand the reason you have to govern your greed, because there's no limit to greed. Greed is the one lust that can never be satisfied. Everything else, you
right.
know, hunger, thirst, sex, all of that stuff, at least for a little while, can be satisfied and give, you can have some relief from it. Greed is not that way. Greed just calls out, "Give me more," over and over. And the root of this is that people want to be rich. And, you know, better get rich slow than get rich quick. I'm not against people having money. I'm not against people being rich. But I have seen more people, more families, more children ruined by an excess of wealth than I have ever seen ruined by poverty.
Right.
And so you're much better off to say, what's the best use for the money that I've got and how can I make it grow over the long term, than you are to waste your time over spider web deals that are never going to come true and they just won't do anything but incite your greed.
You know, it's interesting. I have a habit in my life as an investment advisor helping people. You know, I have people come to me who've been very much harmed by financial fraud, and I help them sort of clean up and reset their house in order and their perspective in order as a result. And one of the things you realize as you get into the stories is that ultimately a lot of people get hooked by their greed. In other words, these things could never work if you followed best practices.
Well,
and
you know,
so
the line that's attributed to Barnum, that there's a sucker born every minute, and that's true. And people are cheated when they are told what they want to hear. The folks who cheat them know that they want to hear this, and they tell them something that reason ought to shout can't possibly be true, but they tell them that it's true, and that's how they're caught by their greed.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be serious with yourself.
It was very funny. I was invited to speak at a conference at the last minute, and I was surprised that they were willing to pay my speaker's fee, but off I went, and there were sitting in the wings two marketing people in charge of marketing for these two newsletters, which I will describe as fairly scummy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and they listened very carefully. Chris Martinson was there, too. So they listened very carefully to everything Chris Martinson and I said. And then when after the conference was over, suddenly all of my update and subscriber and client lists got hit with a very aggressive marketing from both these newsletters. And it was really funny because I would have clients or subscribers email and say, "Oh, I should get this. These guys are saying exactly what you're saying." I said, "No, they're not. They're saying the opposite of what I'm saying." And what I realized was they were using all of my words and expressions. So they'd really done a study of what we were saying and how to say it, and then targeted our list to try and, you know, sign people up. But what they were selling was the end of the world. You know, the collapse is coming and it's momentarily and I'm an insider and you need to know and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And what I realized was, oh, they were basically selling terror, you know, sort of speaking to people's real fear of significant financial loss because of what's going on in the environment. It was very cleverly done. But what they were trying to do was market to people their picture of either what they thought was going to happen or what they were afraid might happen. And it was very cleverly done, but it was clearly a scam. You know, these guys weren't interested in helping people. They were interested in selling whatever they were selling. It's pretty ugly.
Well, I suppose everybody, you know, I suppose that everybody knows, but I don't guess they do, that it's axiomatic in the newsletter industry that the two things that sell are fear and greed.
Right.
Fear of events that might destroy you, and greed for the big hit, you know, the big check, getting
right.
The desire to get rich quick. And that's what sells newsletters. That's what sells financial information.
Let me bring up another one. J.P. Morgan Chase is on its last legs, and they're about to collapse shortly. This one really irritates me. And if you just buy more silver, you'll collapse them shortly. And you know, this one, the reason it so irritates me is, you know, if you look at the operational dependency of the clearing systems and the U.S. government systems on J.P. Morgan Chase and the New York Fed member banks, you're talking about, you know, you're talking about the financial equivalent of ripping up all the train tracks in America if you were really going to let J.P. Morgan Chase go down.
Yeah.
And besides, J.P. Morgan Chase is just a tool. It's a vacuum cleaner. It's, you know, it's a mechanical bureaucracy. The money flows through it, but the money that's stolen doesn't stay in it. And so, you know, I once said, I'll never forget, I was talking to a group of gold bugs who were sure that J.P. Morgan Chase was on its last legs and about to go down. And when it went down, you know, they would win and the bad guys would lose. And I said, are you crazy? The guys who've stolen $40 trillion are now long $40 trillion. You know, they've got some of their liabilities in J.P. Morgan Chase. J.P. Morgan Chase goes down, they just recapitalize it with the U.S. government. And, you know, you're not going to touch their $40 trillion. What do you mean they're going to lose? So, you know, they have a $40 trillion long and a $10 billion short in J.P. Morgan Chase. That you wipe out J.P. Morgan, they don't lose any money.
Well, yeah, but let me add something to that. The people who follow that theory, I believe, are ignorant of the way that a broker works. A broker's obligation, I mean, well, the best strategy as a broker is to never be short or long. You don't make
right.
your money by
right.
the rise or the fall in the market. You make your money by being the middleman for trading whatever the commodity, the stock, or the market is. So what they see is, let's say J.P. Morgan has an enormous short position in New York on the COMEX, and let's say they even have an enormous short position in the OTC market there too. That is balanced by a long position somewhere else. And maybe
right.
the long position is in Hong Kong, maybe it's in London on the London, the LBMA. I don't know where it is, but or in the, you know, the OTC market. But the point is, if you're short a million ounces in one market and you're long a million ounces in another market, you cannot be hurt. Because
right.
whether it goes up or down, you're going to have a balanced position. And so I think when people get all upset about their derivatives position or the J.P. Morgan's derivative position or J.P. Morgan long or short, they neglect that part. They neglect
right.
the possibility, in fact, almost the certainty that for whatever they've got short in one market, they're long in another. I mean,
well, to me, it's the equivalent. If a guy walks into your house and uses a vacuum cleaner to vacuum up all your money and then walks off with the money, mm-hmm. there is nothing to be gained by shooting the vacuum cleaner. Do you know what I mean? So here's the reality, and I keep saying this until I see it catch on in a popular notion. You want the money back. There is nothing to be gained by shooting the vacuum cleaner. If money has been stolen, you want the money back. And I keep saying again and again, crime that pays is crime that stays. So it doesn't matter who you send to jail. It matters that you get the money back in your pocket. So don't, if they say, you know, let's get these guys. No, get your money back. That's what you want to do. You want to get your money back. You don't want people punished. You want yourself, you know, re-remunerated.
Right.
Okay, another one, climate change. You know, This one always makes me furious. But I wrote a review a couple months ago. Naomi Klein has a new book out, which is about as dreadful as it gets, called This Changes Everything. And basically, grossly oversimplified, what it says is climate change is a huge emergency. We have to centralize control and live in poverty to save the planet. And it's interesting because clearly, if you look at the rebalancing of the global economy, there are many, many places. So if you look at China, China has a GNP of $10,000 per capita. We have a GNP of $53,000 per capita. And so if you're going to rebalance, you know, either our productivity has to go up enormously, or our per capita expenditures have to go down enormously, you know, or theirs have to come up, et cetera. So, you know, it's almost as though climate change is fronting for, it's a political excuse to make the rebalancing fashionable by cutting our expenses. But
it is a tool. The whole thing is made up. It's all a tool. I mean, it's 100% a tool. It's a myth that they use. It's a control myth. And, you know, May I take off on that?
Yeah, please take off on this one.
Okay, because this one really gets my motor revved, and I'm up to about 3,600 RPMs already.
Well, you should read that review. It's very good. I really slice Klein's effort.
Here's the thing. You notice the hogwash. Here's how you can smell the hogwash from across the county. They've changed their terminology from global warming to climate change. And the reason is because they've been so manifestly contradicted by the weather in the last few years, where we've had extreme colds, extreme wet in some parts of the country, extreme drought and so forth, but not extreme heat. So back in the 70s, when they first floated this whole environmental movement, back in the 70s, they were telling us about how the whole world was going to freeze to death, there was going to be a new ice age. And then in later years, they skipped to the global warming thing. And all of this has been shown to be a made-up conspiracy, a completely engineered, manufactured out of whole cloth conspiracy. And when I first started, back in the 80s, I was hired by Larry Abraham to help research the environmental movement, and we wrote a book called The Greening. And in fact, I found some copies of The Greening. If any of you writers want them, they can email me, and for $13, I'll send it to them. It's still, we published it in 1993, but it's still valid because it shows you the idea. The idea is taken from a report from Iron Mountain and I think the establishment really believes this, that we produce, that the capitalist economy produces so much that you have to waste a certain portion of it, of that production, in the moral equivalent of war, either by war or the moral equivalent of war. And so they were searching around for something that would give them the, quote, moral equivalent of war, and came up on the environment and the so-called threat to the environment. Well, look, in the United States, by and large, the threat to the environment has been fixed. You know, I mean, this is not 1965 when the Cuyahoga River had so much oil floating down it that it caught on fire.
Right.
This is, you know, here 30 years later, 40 years later, you've got an environment that really has been cleaned a whole lot. And something needed to be done. I'm not...
Well, except somebody's spending billions of dollars to spray crap on our heads. So.
Well, right. I mean, so none of that goes together. None of it makes sense. But what I'm trying to explain is that in the whole global change, climate change, global warming meme, that whole complex of lies is a social myth that's being used to control you. And it's total hogwash from the bottom to the top.
Right.
You know, weather cycles are just incredibly complex. And it is normal when you get increased volcanic activity, and the volcanic activity goes through cycles. When you get increased volcanic activity in the northern hemisphere, what happens is that you get a kind of a shield from heat in the northern hemisphere from the output of those volcanoes, which is huge output of physical tiny matter that goes up into the atmosphere, and you have a long period of global cooling. And then that interacts with the currents in the Pacific Ocean, El Nino and La Nina, and it's just really, really complex. So it is very, very difficult to point to 2 years or 10 years or even 30 years or 100 years and say, look at that.
At this as a tactic, if you're the leadership in the United States and you've got to radically increase productivity or decrease expenditures in the average consumer.
Yes.
You know, if you're facing, I mean, they unleashed a process with the World Trade Organization in the mid-90s. And, you know, that the genie's out of the bottle, it can't get stuff back in. So now that you've done that and the middle class is rising globally, you've got to, you know, you kept the false prosperity going in a whole variety of ways. We did a great interview with Steve Roche, and I think his book is the best to describe how that all worked. But the reality is now you've either got to get productivity up here or you've got to get, you know, living standards down. It's one or the other. And there are many different ways to do it. So I'm not saying we all have to live in poverty whatsoever, but it's a very big change. And so I think climate change is a much better marketing tool than, oh, here's the reality of what we did in the 90s and it's too late. And the truth is not going to sell. So climate change is one of many different fantasies that they've come up with that they think is a way to market all of this.
Well, you have to realize that the environmental movement, which embodies climate change, the climate change myth, or includes the climate change myth, is bigger still, and has this additional myth of overpopulation. Oh, the whole world is going to be filled up with people. We're all going to starve to death. We're not even going to have room to stand up. We're going to be so crowded. It's utter hogwash. Did you realize that by 2050, the world population will go into a steep, steep decline? It's true. What happened was in the 60s, there was a crossover between the Democratic demographic transition and the slowing death rate, where births were still high and deaths were dropping very quickly, and so you got a population bulge. And these people looked at that and said, oh my gosh, we're going to be so overpopulated, we're all going to starve to death here in 30 years, because they straight line extrapolated that change in population. But it's not a straight line, and it has since dropped off. Did you realize that the fertility rate in countries like Germany, Italy, even Spain, all of Europe, the fertility rates are so low that by 2040, 50, 60, those countries, those peoples will cease to exist. They'll be gone.
Well, but the lower fertility rate is really and I think it's one of the reasons they're bringing in so many people from Latin America, because you can't keep Social Security going because of sort of the demographic. It's called demographic winter, and there's no doubt about it that G7 is facing a demographic winter all over the place.
So
you can't get that worked up about this, because I got three more.
All right. So let me just say that overpopulation.
Okay.
But they want to reduce population because it's easier to control. But go ahead.
Here's the thing. When you centralize the financial system, what you do is you draw lots of people into megacities. Mm-hmm. And there you do get, you know, very intense population issues, particularly in a place like China.
Yes.
So, you know, I'll ship you off to Beijing and Delhi. And if you've ever spent a week in Delhi, you know what intense population is. So, there are a lot of population issues, but a lot of it is when you centralize the financial system, that's what you get. You get these very dense locations. Okay, another one. Mother Earth I'll do the Dragon Elders first. And this one is a sad one for me, because it's one I tried very hard to talk Foster and Kimberly Gamble out of, and they've fallen for it hook, line, and sinker. And so now I'm in the position of having to talk all my subscribers out of listening to it. Did you get a chance to take a look at the video I sent to you of them presenting this?
No, I'm sorry, I did not.
Okay, well, essentially what they're saying is that there is that the wealthiest families in the world are what's called the Dragon Elders, which is a group of Asian families, and they are the wealthiest families in the world, not people in the G7. And they're highly spiritual people, and they're going to use their gold to recapitalize the planet. The dollar is going to collapse. In fact, the first time I went through this with them in detail was June, and they said the dollar was going to collapse in July. Of course, it's gone up over 10% since then. They don't know them personally, haven't met them, but they have it on good information that this is all going to happen. And essentially, they're all going to show up and save us. And if you look at everything I know about how the economy works, it's completely in defiance of the facts. So let me just run through the facts as I know them to be. My experience is this planet operates by force. I'm not saying I like that, but that's been my experience. So, you know, if you look at who has the global satellite systems, you know, China has a regional satellite system. The United States and Europe have global satellite systems. The U.S. Navy is the most powerful, but the G7 navies basically control the sea lanes. And so how in the world could a group of Asian families be the wealthiest and be more powerful than the G7 nations, which control the satellites and sea lanes, in a planet where everything is run by force? So that one kind of doesn't make sense to me. But let's just assume that it's true, that even in the face of that, the group of Asian families been able to accumulate enough gold and enough wealth to be wealthier than the people who control the planet by force. If you look at China, and I'll use China as an example, the per capita GNP is about 10,000, or it was 2 years ago, and the U.S. is about 53,000. And China has experienced enormous environmental damage to kind of continue to keep the U.S.'s false prosperity going. You know, we outsource manufacturing to them. They ship lots of goods to Walmart. That kept the consumer game here going. They had an enormously high savings rate. So the Chinese people have worked very, very hard and saved all their money to keep the sort of American consumer in heaven for another 10 to 20 years, and have suffered enormous environmental damage as a result. Why in the world would they use their profits from that to then save and keep the American consumer in heaven, when in fact they haven't used the money to heal the environment where they are or to bring people out of poverty where they are? It doesn't make sense.
Well, not if they're mysteriously benevolent people, as the theory demands. I mean, where's the benevolence in that?
Why don't they
end up at home?
Right. So you would think that if they did have this wealth, that they would first want to finish bringing people out of poverty where they were, and they would want to heal the environment where they were. And you certainly can't imagine that they would say, no, we're gonna use this wealth to recapitalize the well-being and the health of the consumer in the G7. Doesn't make any sense. It's very
it sounds like. I mean, there's this myth. It's the myth of the absent king. The king is absent. You find it in the, Richard the Lionheart, the Robin Hood myth, where the king is good, but there are other bad people between you and him between him and the world or circumstances that keep him from acting so far. But very shortly, he's going to come back and set everything right. And whether this is Frederick the Great sleeping in the hills of Germany, or whether it's Richard the Lionheart in prison in Austria, whatever it is, anyway, the idea is that somebody will come back and set everything right. And in human terms, that just never happens.
Well,
but it is
here's
a myth that's very attractive.
Yeah, I lived in Hong Kong for a year when I studied Chinese during university, and then and I've known very wealthy Chinese families and Asian families. I don't pretend to know if the dragon elders exist or what they're like, but having known very, very wealthy Asian families, I would say that they are remarkably without sympathy for the average American. They see the average American as being lazy and not particularly hardworking and disciplined. And if you look at the brutality of what, of life around them that they see, they have absolute, they see Americans as being very spoiled and having no idea what it is to really work and compete in the kind of world that they have to work and compete in. And the idea that they would use their wealth to support people who they see as hopelessly clueless and spoiled is inconceivable to me. Anyway, so the dragon elder. Now, the other thing is, in there's one other point. In finance, I've always been trained that you have to verify. So if you look at the entire practice in the G7 of financial disclosure and transparency, the whole idea is you have a right to know anything that is material to the making of your investment. So if somebody's going to promote something that would affect how you use your time and money, then you have a right to look at financial statements. You have a right to, do complete due diligence. So the idea that that Franklin, you have it on good inside information from a source that you can't disclose me, and so I can trust that these other people who you've never met are okay. So we have 2 degrees of separation, and it's all done on say so, and there's no verification or disclosure whatsoever. I mean, this is, if you said this to a Wall Street banker, he'd break out laughing. Because there's no verification whatsoever. And so the notion, my fear that someone would listen to this and be influenced in terms of their investment strategy by these kinds of, I have it on inside. It's part of it is playing on people's desire to get inside information, because we all have the feeling somewhere someone knows what's going on, and we'd like to get into that inside circle and get that information.
Oh, that's a
So,
very, very powerful human desire. Very
right.
powerful.
Right. And this is so people tell me, oh, well, it's so hopeful because the people who really run things are really good and they're going to save us all. Okay, so the next one is Benjamin Fulford. Mother Earth has taken over the bank information systems. The energy of the Earth has decoupled the bank information systems, and so they will no longer obey the central banks. And that is very good news. Somebody sent me this seriously and said, this is so hopeful. I thought, oh no. Okay, and the last one, which is when you. Oh, you want to
Can I
talk about
comment on
Mother
that?
Earth?
Just, yeah,
Sure.
comment a little bit. This goes back, and I pointed this out in our 1993 book, The Greening, which I'm plugging again, that a new religion, they have been creating a new religion since the early 70s, and it is a repaganization, a revival of the Mother Earth culture, the Gaia culture, complete with a, quote, scientific magician idea that it's a scientific religion that the whole earth is actually self-conscious and alive. And it's a weird brand of pantheism, but that's where this is coming from. That's what.
Well, I kind of believe that because I think the Holy Spirit is everywhere.
Yeah, but that's quite a different thing than pantheism. Quite a different thing than pantheism.
Well, if you've ever studied morphogenic fields, I do think that there's great science behind sort of, shared intelligence and all those things, but that's a very different kettle of fish than some of the things you're talking about. And to me, this is, again, this is fairy tales with no, you know, no hard evidence. And the funny thing is, the more you get this kind of stuff, the better off they make the corporate media look, which is a terrible thing. It's the last thing you want to have happen. Okay, so the last thing I have to bring up, because you and I have gone through this many, many times, is the future is hopeless. There will be a nuclear war. So I'm going to tell a story. I had one subscriber call me and say, I have, and there was a person who was very wealthy personally. I have $78,000 in credit card debt. What should I do? I said, what do you mean you have $78,000 credit card debt? Why do you have $78,000 in credit card debt? Why don't you just pay your bills? I mean, again, this is person who's very personally wealthy. And they said, oh, well, because the economy was going to collapse. And so I never paid my bill because I knew the economy was going to collapse and I'd be able to get out of it. So-and-so, some newsletter writer, recommended we should all do this, run up our credit cards. And then when the economy collapsed, you know, we just renege on the bill. He said, what should I do? I said, pay it. That's what I wrote back. And he said, well, I can't pay it because I only owe $30,000. The rest is just fees and interest that's compounded because I haven't paid it. And I said, well, call him up and see if you can negotiate him down, but you're liable, pay it. And he wrote back and he said, but why should I pay it? And I said, because that is the price of being an idiot. Anyway, so,
but, you know, that's so, integrity too. And something that's very astonishing to me, I've heard this before, especially from that small sliver of evangelical Christians, and I say small because in comparison to all the Christians in the world, they're not that many, who believe that the rapture is going to take them out of here, boost them out of here before the trouble starts. And so, I'm serious. I'm not making this up now. You're like,
I know.
I'm making this up. And they say, so go out and charge your credit card up because you'll never have to pay it off. Well, you know, that embodies somewhere buried in there, I'm pretty sure, is the idea that God says it's okay for me to steal because I'm going to be boosted out of here by the rapture. I mean, that's a terrible, terrible way to operate. I heard people before Y2K, shortly before Y2K, who were operating on the same delusion, that Y2K was going to take the whole world down, and therefore they could charge up these credit cards, charge up $20,000, $30,000 worth of charges on their credit card, and it would all go away at Y2K. Listen, the one thing you can count on more than
the
else,
banks will find you.
That's right, is the continuity of the system.
Right.
This continuity, system, places where systems break down, occur in history, but they're very rare. The collapse of the Roman Empire did not happen many times. It happened slowly. World War
Right.
One happened once. You know, there was really basically 30 years of war. But you can go back and forth in the centuries, and you will not find discontinuous events like that. And by discontinuous, I mean events that disrupt the whole economy, the payment system, and society. And what these people are doing is they're betting on worse than an inside straight. They're following a smaller chance than an inside straight. And worst of all, their moral motivation is to cheat somebody else. Now, I realize that there's a moral conundrum there, a riddle, because is it possible to cheat a bank? That's the question. I mean, can you be immoral with the immoral? Can you?
Well, it's not immoral to cheat a New York Fed member bank. Let's face it.
I understand the moral quandary, but I think it's better to stay far away from that and say, look, I'm going to pay for what I get in this world because that's what's fair and that's what's
right. And I'm going to do business with somebody I wouldn't want to cheat.
Well, right, exactly.
Right, yeah. Right.
But
right.
These folks who take that outlook, they're believing in a myth for adults, and it's a terribly destructive and immoral myth too.
Right, but I think, you know, I think it is, if you go back and look at what the world, you know, knowing what we know, if you and I were sitting in 1900 looking forward, mm-hmm. we would say, well, it ain't hopeless, but there's a lot to go through. So, you know, I always say the future is created by those who build it, not those who think it's hopeless. So, you know, you know, take hopelessness and get rid of it because it's not very useful. Well, what this all brings me back to is, you know, you're going to laugh, Franklin. I was on a radio show the other day and said, you know, that there was a real mystery, that we didn't know who was really in charge and why they were behaving this way. And I, for one, had spent a lifetime trying to figure it out, and I still didn't know. So somebody wrote on the posted a comment after they listened to the radio show saying, well, you know, she's lying because she was on the inside and, you know, she knows. And I thought, oh, God, that's how bad they think things are. They think all these people really know. They don't understand the naivete and ignorance all the way around. So anyway, but I think when you don't understand what the real governance system is and why people are behaving this way, when you don't understand the black budget and all that stuff, I think, you know, that kind of uncertainty, and then, of course, the rebalancing of the global economy is tearing everything apart left and right. The technology is tearing everything apart left and right. You know, I got 4 billion people on the internet, all in a position to make money with greed and fear from each other. And so that kind of uncertainty means that we don't know what's possible. You know, so if somebody says to me, someone was asking me what I thought of Martin Armstrong's scenario. We apparently said that the U.S. dollar index is going to go to 165, which is where it was back in 1984. So, you know, it hit 122 in, I think it was 2002. And, you know, so the last high was 122, but the 84, the peak was 160. Was 165 and 84. So he said it's going back to that peak. And, you know, and then, of course, on the other hand, you got people saying gold's going to go to 10,000, and they tend to move inversely. So when you look at the swings on the U.S. dollar index and gold of all these scenarios, it's pretty profound. And I, for one, given how extraordinary this rebalancing is, you know, I don't want to say that's impossible, because, in fact, if you look at the range of scenarios of what's possible, it's pretty wide, you know, and that's what happens when you go through a period of change. So what I try and do, and what I'm going to do for the wrap up, is bring it down, as I always do, to a group of scenarios, one of which is the slow burn, you know, because my attitude is, in a world where anything can happen, what you want to do is you want to deploy your assets to make sure you're fine no matter which way it goes.
Yeah.
And this gets back to your making money slow. In other words, you're building a garden, you're building a business, you're putting savings away, you know, in all scenarios, and you're prepared to deal effectively with all scenarios. And that's why I think you got to bring all these scenarios down to, you know, could the dragon elders really exist? Well, yeah, it's a half of 1%. You know, so are they going to save us? Well, that's 1% of 1% of 1%. That's like, but could it happen? In theory, yes. You know, so it's a matter of bringing those scenarios down to the percentages you believe in. And I think, you know, I'm a lot more worried, if you look at the statistics, you know, that you and I are going to have a heart attack this year than you and I are going to get, you know, hit by a nuclear war. So I think part of this is getting out of the world of fearing the extreme scenario and get into the practicality of looking at, you know, the real risks of slipping in the bathtub, having a car accident, or having a heart attack, and doing something about that. So
may I add something to that?
Please.
I run in strange circles, and I meet a lot of really well-meaning people of integrity, upright people, but I have met many, many folks whose lives have been literally ruined, wrecked by concentrating on the end of the world, a collapse, the you know, the collapse of the dollar, the collapse of society, the collapse of this, that, or the other, and literally their lives have been ruined because they have prepared for the smallest outcome, and it has taken over their life. And so now they're backed into a corner. They painted themselves into a corner, and there they sit on 500 pounds of beans with their .45 revolver in their hand, waiting for the marauding hordes to come.
Right.
That's just, it's sad, Catherine. I'm serious. It's sad. It breaks my heart when I talk to these people and realize they've put their whole life in pawn to this idea that may never come true and probably won't come true because the one thing that has inertia in the world is continuity of the system.
Right.
If there are 5.5 billion people in the world, every one of them gets up in the morning not thinking, uh-oh, what am I going to do when the world collapses today? They get up in the morning thinking, how am I going to work today so that my world doesn't collapse?
Right.
So
you've got everybody on the planet trying to make money, getting the system to work.
Right.
That is a mighty, mighty force. Right. It's a mighty, mighty force.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, the moral of the story is, you know, when it comes to adult fantasies and extreme scenarios, or I call them adult fairy tales. When it comes to adult fairy tales and extreme scenarios, they're very entertaining. They're very stimulating. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to deploying your assets, you want to deploy your assets, your time and your money to deal with the likely scenarios. So if you want to deploy some for the extreme scenarios, fine. Just remember, you know, you need most of your assets to deal with likely. So, and I'm with you. Put up a sign on your desk saying, earn, you know, get rich slow. My mother was a Quaker, and she used to always, you know, regale us with slow and steady wins the race. But it's true.
It is true. Exactly.
I know it's true. So speaking
but
of which,
really
one more.
Yeah? Do you really don't think that the Iraqi dinar is going to come back?
You know, there's a 1%, a 1%, a 1%. What can I tell you?
Okay.
So, you know, I believe Jesus is coming back. I believe he's here. So, you know, I can't laugh at people who think that, you know, they laugh at me. So, anyway, but I, you know, I think there's a much better chance of Jesus being here than the Iraqi dinar is going to come back. So, there you got it. I did want to talk about being your own doctor, because speaking of taking care of the likely scenarios, you have a story to tell. You're going to share the blue algae story, and then I'm going to share a couple others and tell what it means. So tell everybody about how what I did for you this month.
Oh, this is a fabulous favor, it really was. Years ago, I used to take blue-green algae because, and when I say years ago, I'm talking about in the early 80s, because it supposedly helps your mental sharpness, and maybe it helps energy levels too, but certainly mental sharpness. And I used to take it, and you know how you do things in your life, you kind of forget about them. You get off of them and you kind of forget about them. And I guess it was about a month or month and a half ago, you said to me, you've been visiting with a subscriber out in Nevada, and he was talking about blue-green algae and told you that you ought to take 30 of those 500 milligram caps a day. And I nearly dropped the phone. I thought, oh, gosh, that's a huge number of those pills. And I couldn't gag that many down. I could do 15, okay? 15 I can try. So I got some of this stuff. And it's blue-green algae from Oregon, and all of it says Klamath on it. There are a lot of different brands, but it's I can't remember the first name of the Latin designation, but the last part of it is Flos Aqua. Aphanamon Flos Aqua, I think it is. Anyway, so I started taking this stuff, and I'm not joking. In about 3 weeks, my brain came back. It was like it had been on vacation. And yesterday I was doing a calculation for a customer, and the customer asked me how much 90% was, and I said, well, it's $13,142 a bag. And she said, well, what would a half bag be? And I said, oh, well, a half bag would be $6,571. I never even thought about it. I mean, it was just, it's that kind of thing. I didn't have to dig out the calculator and write it all down on a piece of paper. It's just, your mind just works so well. And I haven't done anything other than take the blue-green algae. Now, that might not work.
Well, I'm glad you said this, because if I told you how much spirulina and blue-green algae I live on.
Yeah.
And, you know, my theory is your body needs protein, and to get it in a form which is not, you know, if I tried to get that much protein in steak. I'd have to crawl around.
A cow a day, I know.
Right. So I just think, you know, we need the nutrition, and that is the efficient way to get it. And well, I love that stuff. I live on it.
You have to tell your story about vitamin C now.
Right. So Franklin did a great article in the Money Changer, I guess it was 2 months ago, on vitamin C. And so I thought, you know, I need to start taking vitamin C again. So it just came in, and I'm looking forward to that. But the reason I wanted to bring this up is you and I have a long tradition, and part of it is there's such great stuff in the Money Changer. And I would mention you took a lot of the interviews in the Money Changer on health and published them as a book. And is that book still available on your website?
It is. I've not updated it, and I've got several things I need to put back in it. But
it's very good.
It's the Money Changer's good. Yeah.
It's one of the reasons I love the Money Changer is the health things. But Franklin and I come from a long tradition of realizing that the last thing you ever want to do, you only want to go to a hospital or a doctor when you absolutely have to. And so you want to do everything you possibly can yourself. And a lot of that is educating yourself. And I'm always getting great tips from you on the Money Changer, but I'm always trying to send them back too.
Hey, I appreciate it. I really do.
And I, you know, I don't think there is one old timey, you know, recipe that we haven't gone through, tried, swapped, figured out. And, but I think, you know, I think what's been amazing to me, Franklin, is that I'll give you an example. Whenever I have a problem, there are three things I first use. So iodine, a castor oil pack, and various forms of detox. So whenever I have a problem, those three things get applied, and I don't consider going to a doctor unless the three won't work. And they work for 90% of what ails me. Now, I'm not saying that's going to be true for another person because everybody's different. But, you know, I look back, and when I think of all the times those three things worked, you know, maybe 100 times, if I'd gone to a doctor, I'd be much poorer, and I'd be much sicker because they would have chopped me up. Put me in surgery. God knows what would have happened to me. So,
you know, it's fascinating to me that you just mentioned those things, because I've had a recent experience with iodine, supersaturated potassium iodide solution, and which you can get from Tahoma Clinic Dispensary, and I think it's $18 for an ounce or something like that, but it's hugely strong. And a doctor friend of mine said, look, take that stuff and mix it half and half with DMSO and use that. And I've got to tell you, for molds or warts, it just takes it away. It just gone.
Yeah. It would be particularly gruesome for me to describe all the different things I had done.
Well, yeah.
But I just slap it on. You know, I got a problem, I slap it on, and it's like a miracle drug.
Well, castor oil is the same way, you know.
Yeah.
Castor oil is a very potent anti-inflammatory.
Right.
So you can, you know, if you have arthritic pain in your hands or joint pain or muscle pain, you can use castor oil for that. And castor oil also will take off warts and do a lot of other things. But it's really a potent medicine, and it's inexpensive and easy to use. And you know, it's the worst thing's going to happen is, what's the worst side effect? You're greasy. I mean, you don't fall down.
Well, if it doesn't work, if it doesn't work, you had a nice relaxing castor oil pack and you're greasy, and that's the worst thing that can happen. So, you know, to me, there's very little downside, and there's nothing like doing it yourself. So anyway, so let me give another plug for do it yourself, but I'm glad the algae worked. And I will say, spirulina and algae to me are the greatest form of, you know, high quality nutrition with very little bulk. So I'm glad it worked. Okay. Well, Franklin, before we close down, thank you very much. We've gone through gold and silver. We've gone through the rebalancing of the global economy. We've touched on the calculator and gifting to the children we loved. We've talked about scenarios for the 2015 investment strategies and regaled our frustration with adult fairy tales. The last thing I have to bring up, just because I know how much you and Susan appreciate red wine, mm-hmm. is I don't know if you had a chance to watch the documentary for this week's Salieri Report Red Obsession.
Not yet, no.
Okay, well, I want to recommend it to you because it is, you know, one way to understand the rebalancing of the global economy is to look at it through the lens of one product. And this documentary, it's a marvelous documentary. It's narrated by Russell Crowe, does a fabulous job, describes the bubble in Bordeaux wines as a result of the Chinese obsession during the years 2008, 2010, when you had two extraordinary vintage years. Mm-hmm. And it's hysterical. If you love wine, you're going to find it very interesting. But talk about a bubble coming from demand for, you know, in a thin market. Mm-hmm. It's one that you would, you know, dealing in precious metals, it's one you would appreciate. Anyway, so I recommend it to you. If you don't have a chance this week to go to Shanghai and get a feel for what it's like, you'll get a feel. You know, of course, the Australians are down there being bubbled by it every week, so they know. Anyway, okay, well, this has been wonderful. Before we close, anything you want to add?
Oh, I think, yes, I want to add something about the gold and silver markets. It's too early to say that stocks have topped yet. They look like they have, but it's just a little bit too early to say that stocks have topped and gold and silver have bottomed. But that time is here, and it will be made obvious in the next few months. And I'm just about as sure as I get that within the first 6 months of next year, you will have seen the stocks top and the gold and silver bottom. And silver and gold will have begun that long process of rebuilding a base and beginning to rally again.
But I just got to add, I'm a skeptic because I think the U.S. markets will probably top. You know, if interest rates start heading up, the U.S. equity markets will probably top. But, you know, there's stock markets all around the world that have been, you know, way clocked. And commodities as well. So the question is, will they start to come back with precious metals? Big question.
Right.
So, I don't know. It could be worse. You could be in the oil markets, down 37% for the year.
Yeah, and you know, the thing that's scary about oil is that stocks, the S&P tends to track the oil. And so, I know,
right.
Whereas that may, the decline in oil may be good news for the aircraft energy industry and for, you know, people, the middle class, especially people who have spent a lot large part of their income on gasoline, but for the stock market in general, it's not such good news. So,
I think the problem that the U.S. stock market had, Franklin, was how do you keep up corporate earnings? You know, they've kept up corporate earnings mostly with buybacks. And I think oil could really help, certainly not the oil sector, but it could help the manufacturing, a lot of the other sectors keep up earnings, and it could keep money in the consumer's pocket, which was also going to be a big problem. But with a global slowdown, I just think corporate earnings are going to struggle. So, and that's part of what could top everything out.
Right. Well, what the dropping oil price and also, the commodity indices are pointing to is trouble in the global economy, I think. So we'll see.
I live in Hardeman County. We've had trouble in the global economy for the last 20 years. But here's the thing, and this is, you know, it's Christmas time, so we should talk about it. You can't build a strong economy if you fight. And, you know, right now there is a complete multiple personality disorder. Everybody's trying to, you know, fight dirty, and there is an unraveling in the global order. And you can't make money if you're killing each other. So, and you can't make money if you're pouring all your money down military expenditure hole. So I think the cost of force is continues to go up, and one of the things it's going to cost us is is the, you know, people trusting in trade and doing business together.
Yeah.
So
it's the worst thing that could happen to the economy. War is the worst thing that could happen to the economy.
But, right. So
but the
what,
US, you know, operates and has operated in the last 30, 40 years on a Platt balance. That's the way.
Right. So peace on earth, goodwill to men is what the economy needs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Odd, isn't that?
Franklin, you and yours have a wonderful, wonderful Christmas.
Oh, same to you, Kat.
Good. Goodbye.
Okay. Bye-bye.